Welcome to the podcast of America This Week, courtesy of the Catholic Channel on Sirius XM 129. If you want to listen to more, subscribe to Sirius XM and tune in on Wednesdays at 1 p.m. Eastern on the Catholic Channel, Sirius XM 129.
Hello, this is Tim Reedy, and I am sitting in here for Carrie Weber on America This Week. Carrie's actually at the Catholic Press Association Conference up in Quebec City, Canada, yep. So she'll be reporting back on that when she comes back later this month. Joined, as always, by Father Matt Malone and Robert David Sullivan, Associate Editor. And Robert, we're going to talk a bit about the article you brought to the table today, which is by our correspondent Tim Padgett, about some of the issues related to climate change and the rising sea waters in the Miami area.
Right. Tim is our Miami correspondent. He has a story that's now up on americamagazine.org that deals with Miami being kind of in the vanguard of responses to the rising sea level. You said earlier that, you know, the phrase water is life, and can be a complicated relationship. people tend to want to live near the water, but now we have to deal with the matter of a lot of the infrastructure and a lot of our housing is now at risk of rising sea level and more frequent flooding. Tim wrote about Miami because, as I said, it's one of the first major cities to face that issue, and because last fall there was a viral video of an octopus that was swimming around in a parking garage in Miami Beach because there was so much flooding, and this has become such a regular occurrence that that's not exactly a shocking development to find sea life in your daily commute. You come across sea life like that and have to deal with rowing to work or something like that. So it's happening more and more there, especially in Miami Beach, which is separate from Miami, and it's an island, and it's very built up, very developed, a very popular place to live and to visit. And they're having to cope with what to do about this. One thing that we never seem to do is say we're going to retreat.
Retreat from the beach.
Right. We don't do that. So the debate in Miami Beach is more about do they try to preserve the housing stock they have or build anew? And Tim's report says that a lot of it, they are going to try to preserve what they have and kind of raise a lot of houses onto stilts, which is kind of the old-fashioned way of development. In the, when the Spaniards first came to Florida, a lot of the housing in that area was actually built on stilts. You can see a lot of that around New Orleans now as well. And that's going to be seen as kind of a test case as to whether this is a good way to proceed in other cities, because we have like 14 million people that live in coastal areas that are now at risk of regular flooding from the rising sea level. And there's a lot of development that's there that we have to, a lot of investment, and we have to figure out how to proceed. And at this point, it's not really a question of what's causing this, because it's happening and we have to respond
to it.
It doesn't really matter if you deny climate change if your living room is flooded,
right?
You'd still have a problem.
And God isn't going to suck back the seas at any time soon. It's something.
You know, I go to Miami once a year to escape the gray cold of Manhattan. And I was walking back from the gym to my friend's house, and it started to rain. It was a big thunderstorm like we had just this week here in Manhattan, and the water started coming up from the ground,
right,
you know, and almost like a small geyser, you know,
like out of the sewers and such,
but out of the ground itself.
Wow.
Like up through the grass of the park.
Yeah.
And I was like, holy Toledo, this place is like a quarter of an inch above sea level, right? And you know, so I got back and I said to my friend, I said, you know, this whole place is in danger, you know, because of the rising sea levels and so forth. And he said what you said. He said, well, everybody's thinking about how do we put our houses on stilts and all of that stuff. And I said, well, you can't put the Fountain Blue Hotel on stilts, right? I mean, you can't take a 30-story high-rise tower and put that on stilts. I mean, it invites these practical questions of how do we really deal with these things, but then, you know, a philosophical question about, you know, is this a place really where people should be living in light of what is happening? And, you know, these questions were asked about, New Orleans,
yeah.
Right? And it seems like we only ask them when we're talking about poor people, why do they live there? But, you know, the folks of the Fountain Blue, we don't ask that question. But if it's a question worth asking, it's worth asking of everyone.
Yeah, and it's not just, I mean, in those areas, I mean, you think about, New York, too. I mean, they're studying what's going to happen with the rising sea levels for the Battery. I can't picture office buildings on stilts, but, you know, maybe, you know, the architects can do it.
Well, one of the things I felt kind of stupid reading this, because maybe everybody knows this, Venezuela was named after Venice.
Oh, Venice. I didn't know that either.
Yeah. Little Venice. And they have
I didn't know that
until I read this. And they evidently do have some areas like that where they do have buildings above water, like Venice, and maybe Venice, which we see as a very unique in the United States, we see it as a very unique exotic place, might become more of a model for American cities.
And it should be pointed out, like, that we are all in one way or another paying for this, because, like, you look at some of the beaches in New Jersey and elsewhere where when they do lose some beachfront, like Superstorm Sandy, the federal government comes in, the Army Corps of Engineers, and puts sand down, you know, and that's always, there's a lot of money plowed back in. So, as you say, there's no discussion of moving houses back. We're just going to keep fighting, throwing more sand at the problem.
And Boston, which I'm sure you know, the hot new neighborhood in Boston is the Seaport, which is right on the harbor. And now they're talking about building seawalls around it and to protect these skyscrapers that are shooting up there. And I don't think anyone ever really talks about, well, maybe we should move inland instead of, like, I don't know how much it's going to cost to reinforce this new neighborhood, but it's going to cost a lot.
Yeah, indeed it is. And you know, the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers were also the ones that built the levees in New Orleans that failed after Hurricane Katrina. And, you know, this is an important question, because whatever intervention there is, it's going to be hugely expensive, whether it comes from the private sector, the public sector, or some collaboration between the two. But it's going to be hugely expensive and hugely complicated to undertake. And then the question becomes, yet again, is this something that only the more affluent are able to do, the more affluent communities and private actors, and the poor are the ones who have to move? And does that then, you know, just feed into the whole problem that we have here, the class divide in this country and the increasing... not only the increasing disparity in income levels, but you know, our separation from one another along lines of class and race and so forth. So, important questions to be talking about, and questions that in some way our guest today has addressed.
We are very happy to have with us Eileen Markey, who is the author of A Radical Faith, which I mentioned, a biography of Sister Mora, the assassination of Sister Mora, which was just released, I believe, last year, and we had her on our show back then. Eileen, are you with us?
I am, yeah. Great to be with you.
Great to have you from reporting from the Bronx. Nice to have you here.
Nice to have you back.
Now, Eileen, maybe you could talk about, I know that this was a story that we worked with you on, and kind of, we knew that this was a story that had to be told about what was happening at Standing Rock, and maybe you could just bring our listeners up to speed on the protests that have been going on there and where things stand right now.
Yeah, well, so this piece looked at the phenomenon of Standing Rock, the protests that occurred there all last year and gathered a lot of pace over the summer and then came to a climax in the fall and winter, and then were dispersed. But I knew from speaking to activists and religious people that there was just so much energy and inspiration and sort of power in those protests and in what people experienced when they went out to join those camps, that lots of people were saying, well, what happens now? I mean, beyond the particular case of the Dakota Access Pipeline and the sovereignty issues for those Lakota Sioux, the idea that there were all these activists, all these people who cared about the environment and who understood a religious underpinning to their environmental care had been so activated by that protest, what was happening next. So my story really looks at post-Standing Rock, where does that energy and that kind of renewed consciousness move to? So what I found is that there were a lot of these similar protest camps around the country in several different states, people who are worried about the environmental impact, particularly the water purity impact of either natural gas pipelines or oil pipelines. And so there's these camps of people very much like Standing Rock, but on a smaller scale, protesting in different parts of the country. And then, of course, there's more typical, less radical or less extreme work around the importance of pure water and access to drinking water, playing out in terms of lobbying and activism and letter writing, and religious congregations are very much a part of that.
Well, that's an interesting part of the story. Maybe you can talk more about that. I mean, in your book, of course, you write about Sister Mora and the religious order she belonged to and their work down in El Salvador. How are religious sisters in particular involved in this issue?
Yeah, they're really centrally involved. So sisters, as well as Jesuits were, and many other religious people were out at Standing Rock. But like here in New York, there's the religious organizations along the Hudson, which is an interfaith coalition, but it includes the Mary Knoll Sisters, the Sisters of Charity, the Sisters of St. Joseph of Peace in New Jersey. They all work together to care for the Hudson River. So that some of that came out of old pressing New York State and especially GE, General Electric, to clean up the Hudson River after they'd contaminated it. And so they continue to do work around water quality issues in the Hudson, including a really interesting place called Water Spirit, which is the Sisters of St. Joseph of Peace in New Jersey, have a retreat center on the Jersey Shore where they, people go to go on retreat, but it's retreats focused on environmental care and on integrating an understanding of yourself and your own journey and your own spirituality as vitally linked to the physical world and vitally linked, obviously, to water and access to water and in a beautiful place on the Jersey Shore where you can do that. So that's one of the missions of those sisters and several others. And like I spoke to Sisters of Charity of Halifax up in Canada, who are involved, as many religious communities are, in shareholder activism. It's such a really, I think, really innovative way to leverage a small amount of power that a congregation might have, right, by owning stock where it keeps its, its retirement funds, and then turning that into, okay, we're going to put forward shareholder resolutions that say that the companies that we're invested in need to respect water rights, need to respect tribal sovereignty, need to do real analysis about access to water and sustainability in terms of how their companies work. So the Sisters of Charity of Halifax have done that. And the Jesuits as well, the Midwest province in particular, is involved in some of those shareholder activism jobs. So there's, kind of as I found in doing the research around Mora and the Mary Knolls in Central America, there's all sorts of different roles that people are involved in, right? Not everyone does the very most intense frontline work of leaving their job and camping out on the high prairie for 6 months. Other people do going to meetings and testifying before Congress and holding hearings and writing letters, right?
Mm-hmm. And as you point out, Eileen, a lot of people own stock in a company, but the sisters actually show up to these shareholder meetings
and
you use their status as stockholders to try to hold people accountable, right?
Yeah, and it's not like they're 50% stockholders.
Right.
It's not like they have controlling interests in the companies. But the world of shareholder activism is this really interesting incremental poco a poco thing where you put forward a resolution and you try to get 2% of the other shareholders to go for it, and companies sometimes end up making adjustments to their policies even when the shareholder resolutions don't pass, right? Even when they're not commanded to, there's this sense of like, we've got enough of our shareholders thinking about this issue, which is not central to the work of, whatever the company does.
And this, this coalition, this kind of loose coalition of groups that has been fighting or protesting in defense of clean water. What is it about these pipelines and this moment that has really motivated them to act in such a dramatic way?
I think for most of the people I spoke to, it was a feeling that the balance of power between business community and civilians and private citizens was completely out of whack. So, for example, the people in Lancaster County, Pennsylvania, who had organized into Lancaster Against Pipelines, they initially started, it was just, individual citizens going to their town council meetings when they got a notice that said, pipeline's coming through your backyard, kind of, you have to notify property owners of that sort of thing. And so people went to their, city council meetings, not even town council meetings, right, and said, I don't think this is a good idea. How about we look at this? There have been plenty of reporting on, combustions and lots of leaks of natural gas, especially in that western Pennsylvania area. So people saying, can we have a resolution in our town that actually we don't want this coming through our beautiful bucolic town? And that's something that people might debate. People might say, well, actually, we really need the energy, and this is the way that we deliver it nowadays. Or people might say, you know what, there's a calculus between jobs and environmental purity. We're going to choose jobs. Those are debates one might have. But what these citizens in these small towns in Pennsylvania found is that their towns were legally prevented from even adopting a resolution saying we don't want pipelines in our town. So they weren't permitted to do that because the energy industry is so powerful. Really alarmed people.
And they had
right?
they had lobbied lawmakers to pass some kind of law that prevented them.
And
from...
the lawmakers said, and they were correct, actually, we can't pass a law like that.
Right.
The company could sue us if we passed a law like that. And there are, slap suits, and there are legal restrictions on what a municipality can do that might have a deleterious effect on the ability of the energy company to make money.
And they might...
these people, some of these people are Republicans, right? They're
sure.
saying, I believe in private property, or I believe in the rights of local jurisdictions to make their own laws. This seems really like a dictatorship. This seems not right.
Right.
So that drove some of the people to first go from, all right, we don't need this little town and that little town and that little town organization. We're going to build an organization of people worried about energy, across the county.
And it would seem to me that the municipalities may not even have the resources to mount a defense, given the, prohibitive costs of legal counsel and so forth and all of that.
Right. No, they would be bankrupted.
Right.
They would end up not having money to run their school systems.
Right.
And that's alarming and extreme, and I don't think something you would expect to see happening in the United States. So that was really the impetus for many of the people with whom I spoke, this sense of this is not a balanced playing field at all. The citizens have so little power compared to the business interests.
Right. You're listening to America This Week on the Catholic Channel, Sirius XM 129. We're speaking with Eileen Markey, whose article, The Spirituality of Standing Rock, is the cover story in the June 26, 2017 issue of America Magazine. Eileen is an investigative journalist whose work has appeared in the New York Times and New York Magazine, the Wall Street Journal, and of course the best of them all, America Magazine.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And we will take a quick break and come back and have more of our conversation with Eileen Markey. You're listening to the Catholic Channel on Sirius XM 129.
Now, back to America This Week, live on the Catholic Channel, Sirius XM 129.
Hello, this is Tim Reedy sitting in for Carrie Weber on America This Week, joined as always by Father Matt Malone, and with us this week, Associate Editor Robert David Sullivan. And we are talking with Eileen Markey, who's the author of A Radical Faith, The Assassination of Sister Maura, but also, more importantly for our purposes, the author of The Spirituality of Standing Rock, which appears in the June 26th issue of America. Now, Eileen, one issue you just touched on in our earlier conversation, which is very interesting to me, is that this is a cause that it's obviously there are various kinds of protesters involved here, but it seems to be cutting across political classes, or that you have people from places like Lancaster, Pennsylvania, who are upset about this, as well as, you know, this very strong protest in Standing Rock. So is it the notion that water is something that needs to be protected that is perhaps more in danger now than it had been? You know, what kind of is drawing this passion from so many different kinds of people?
Yeah, I think the protests at Standing Rock, I think, just captured so many people's imaginations, right? I know on the East Coast, anyway, we very rarely think about Native American issues, right? It's different if you live in the Pacific Northwest or if you live in the Upper Midwest, maybe, but I know for a lot of us on the East Coast, it's like, oh, right, you know, maybe you'd gone on a service trip or something in college, but weren't really continuing to think about Native issues. So the idea of all of these different nations gathering together, different Native nations gathering together at Standing Rock was so, you know, in the photos you saw in the New York Times, it just captured the imagination, and there was something really powerful about that. And the fact that it was, at least from the point of view of the Lakota organizers, the earliest organizers, it was a deeply, deeply religious protest, right? There was this sacred fire attended by Lakota leaders day and night, by Lakota elders. There were prayer every morning. There was procession to the water, to the Cannonball River that people believed was, you know, endangered by this pipeline. So it was this deeply spiritual thing, in, you know, that also brought up issues of sovereignty and land, and obviously these environmental issues. And I think people, I don't know, maybe people are ever ready to be able to tap into that, especially maybe in this year where we've seen so much political acrimony and anger and fear and protest, that here's one that was deeply rooted in religious ideas. It was a religious protest. That's certainly the case among the people I spoke to, that their motivation for doing the work they do is a religious one, and that they see, you know, it's water of life, it's waters of baptism, it's the Jordan River, it's, right? You can't, for someone who's Catholic or someone who's Christian or really many other religions, water is so deeply a religious symbol. And then when you get into the sort of theology that especially many women religious are studying, you know, the idea of our connectedness to the rest of creation, water is, you know, 80% of our bodies, right? It's where our earliest single-celled ancestors emerged from. So there's this whole integrative idea about we are part of the water, and the water is vital to us. And there are many things that are important for a person to live, but water is really kind of the first of them. So the notion that our access in the United States to clean, free, or very cheap drinking water is under threat is just shocking to people and motivating enough to get people to do something. I mean, when you think about the Flint water crisis, which I don't talk about in my piece, but, you know, there are hundreds, thousands of children in the United States who are poisoned and permanently brain damaged because they didn't have access to clean drinking water in the United States because of decisions that were made around municipal budgets and state budgets, right? I think that motivates people as well.
Well, one thing about Standing Rock, though, is it was so visually arresting because we could see the water, we could see where the pipeline was going. Do you think this raised consciousness among people like most of us who don't come into daily contact with our drinking water source and maybe have kind of put it in the back of our minds of where this is coming from? It's just like making us think about that in ways that we were kind of ignoring before.
Yeah, right. I think it certainly could. I live in New York City, and we're always very proud in New York about our water. New York City owns hundreds of thousands of acres of land upstate, which border the reservoirs that made New York City possible in the middle of the 19th century. And, you know, partly because of that, our governor and state legislature ruled against fracking, the process of natural gas extraction in New York State a few years ago. And that didn't happen, you know, because I woke up one morning and decided to do that. That happened because there was a years-long campaign by people concerned about water quality to demand that the state come out strongly and say our water is more valuable than cheap energy.
Not to take it for granted.
not to take it for granted and to take affirmative steps to protect it. What I think is interesting about the protests I visited and the other ones I spoke to, these camps in particular, is they're so local, right? It's literally, well, this was going to go through my backyard, and I have well water, and so that made me think. And so now I'm talking to my neighbors, and now we've decided to all go camp on so-and-so's land to defend it against eminent domain. That is really interesting to me, this consciousness and connection to place in this cyber age when so many communities are dispersed, that people you spend the most time with in your day might actually be in another city or another country. A lot of people's lives and identities are mitigated mostly online. But this movement is hyper-local and physical and together and in place, which I think there's really important incarnational ideas in that.
And, you know, the Pope would think that too, right? And he has talked about integral development in his encyclical, his second major encyclical, Laudato Si, on the care of our common home. And you say in the article that some of the religious actors, at any rate, who are involved in these protests, were motivated by what the Pope said in that encyclical. And I wonder if you could talk a little bit about that.
Yeah. If any of your listeners have not read that yet, go read it. It really says everything.
Right.
Really, on water, on neighborhood relations, on relations between person and government, on human rights. It's absolutely an amazing piece of research and writing.
It should. Yeah, it's like 184 pages long.
It's not, you know, like it's not, yeah, it's like one novel. It's not hard to read. Yeah, definitely. So many of the people I spoke to cited that, you know, especially when I, you know, show up and say I'm writing for this Catholic magazine. It's like, oh, your Pope. Your Pope is amazing. Have you read that environmental encyclical? That's incredible. You know, including a woman I spoke to who's Cherokee and grew up in Oklahoma and now lives in Louisiana and is involved in an effort to prevent a pipeline going through the bayou in South Louisiana. She's not Catholic, but she read Laudato Si and said, you know, you guys know the story, right? Like, you know what you're supposed to be doing. She actually had this amazing quote where she said something like, I don't understand how people can love God and then allow the environment to be destroyed. It's like saying you think Picasso is a great artist and then ripping up his paintings.
Mm.
But, you know, the work that the Pope and his advisor just did in writing that encyclical really showed how, like, what great intelligence he gets, right? Like, how much research there was. It was right up to date on so many of the biggest issues facing particularly indigenous communities and poor communities all over the world around access to water. And the Jesuits have adopted, the Jesuits, you know, worldwide have adopted the Amazon as a region of particular concern and a region that where the rights of the people there need to be addressed, and various Jesuit ministries are doing that. And so that's part of the piece as well, talking about a coalition of people, including a bishop who came up from Brazil and other Amazonian region countries to testify at the Inter-American Court of Human Rights around the death threats and the actual killings of water activists in that region. You know, it's a lot of things happening in the U.S., but they are very much of a piece with things that have happened in other countries. And Standing Rock was so clearly that.
Right.
You know, indigenous against a very powerful energy corporation, much like Berta Cáceres in Honduras, an indigenous Honduran woman who was killed by either the military government or agents of the hydroelectric company that wanted the land that she wanted to stay in indigenous hands, right? These patterns are similar in different, in different parts of the world. And Laudato Si speaks really clearly about that, about the right to consultation of local communities, whether they're indigenous or whether they're other people, the right of local people to make decisions and to be consulted. And that water is a human right. It's not just another commodity. It's not like, well, you know, you can't afford a nice car, take the bus. Like, no, everybody has a right to water. It's really a central value.
Yeah. Have any of the Catholic bishops in the United States sided with these movements?
There were statements from some during Standing Rock of, you know, very carefully worded, but saying, you know, actually more around the sovereignty issues. The
right.
Native people here have a right to their sovereign lands. But, you know, Bishop McElroy in San Diego has been really clear on a lot of popular movement issues. And then the Jesuits made a statement in support of Standing Rock as well around sovereignty and access to water. Nobody's made a statement, I don't know if anybody's been asked to, about these particular camps that I wrote about.
It's interesting, as you're talking, Eileen, that there's a connection, obviously, that you probably see, but it's occurring to me now, between your book, The Assassination System, Mark Clark, and the kind of political involvement that was involved of that generation of women religious, and what we're seeing now, and people like Dorothy Stang, who have been martyred for their work for the environment. So there are some parallels there that must have been clear to you in your reporting.
Yes. I mean, I think everybody has one good idea in their life. mine is that...
We're still waiting for mine.
Faith and politics are intricately linked. So I certainly, you know, I saw that when I was thinking about reporting this piece and became curious about it, and then as I was reporting it. But yes, definitely, even as I was researching the book on Maura Clark and spending a lot of time with Mary Knowles and with other women religious, so much of their work nowadays is on environmental care. So much of their work, including there's a Sister Peg Dillon, a woman who's in the book on Maura Clark a lot. She was a very good friend of hers. Lived through the war in Nicaragua, did great human rights work throughout the 1980s, now lives in Panama in a remote region in a center that does environmental sustainability, environmental care, and spiritual care. In fact, there's a very good, I don't know if I should name some of your competition, but there's a really good article in Global Sisters Report this week about Melinda Roper, who now lives in that community in Panama doing that spirituality and environmental care work. Melinda Roper was president of the Mary Knowles Sisters when the church women were killed in 1980. And she sees a direct connection, right? The crisis at that time was civil wars and the edge of the Cold War in Central America. The crisis at this moment is much, much bigger, actually. It's a existential environmental crisis. And so the sisters, of course, are on the front lines creatively and humbly and interestingly doing the work that they can.
Right. We have about a minute left before we have to go, Eileen, but I wanted to ask you, what surprised you in reporting this story?
I think what surprised me is the extent of license, the extent of authority that different energy companies have over public land, over private citizen land. It just didn't make it into the story. You always do a lot more reporting than you end up writing. But the state park near where I grew up in Massachusetts, a pipeline is going through it. It's a state park. It's a place to go camping.
Right.
but that doesn't... The fact that it's parkland is trumped by the fact that an energy company wants to put pipelines through. I mean, the disbalance of power between one particular industry and a whole lot of other potential values, right?
Right.
And a whole lot of individual citizens and municipalities and governments and policies. The energy company has way more power than any of the others, and that really surprised me.
Right. Eileen Markey is an independent reporter and the author of A Radical Faith, The Assassination of Sister Maura. She can be found in the pages of America, actually on the cover of June 26, 2017, The Spirituality of Standing Rock. Eileen, thanks so much for being with us.
Thanks for having me. Great to be with you.
Okay. That is an amazing story.
Yeah, and I know for those of us who have been following this issue, the involvement of women religious is kind of clear to us, but I think it's worth emphasizing because the Laudato Si, I don't think it would have happened without the work of these women religious out there.
I think you are right. Well, you have been listening to America This Week on the Catholic Channel, Sirius XM 129. To learn more about the stories that we have talked about today, you can join us at americamagazine.org. You can also follow us on Twitter and on Facebook. And you can also subscribe to America Magazine at americamagazine.org. It's a smart Catholic take on faith and culture. For Robert David Sullivan and Tim Reedy, I'm Father Matt Malone. Thank you and good day.
Thank you for listening to the podcast of America This Week, courtesy of the Catholic Channel on SiriusXM 129. If you want to listen to more, subscribe to SiriusXM and tune in on Wednesdays at 1 p.m. Eastern on the Catholic Channel, SiriusXM 129.